Hello, and welcome to the CISC podcast. In each edition of this series, you'll have the chance to meet a CISC staff member or other educational professional involved with the CISC community. We think you will find these podcasts of great value as a variety of people share their unique insights in their respective fields. Now, please enjoy this edition of the podcast as our host, Bob Kretzmer, speaks with our guest.
The Fiscal Crisis and Management Assistance Team, known as FICMAT, was created by legislation in 1991 as an independent and external state agency. FICMAT's mission is to assist California's local educational agencies to identify, prevent, and resolve financial, operational, and data management challenges. FICMAT provides management assistance and professional learning opportunities. These services are used not only to help avert fiscal crisis, but also to promote sound financial practices. Michael Fine has been FICMAT's chief executive officer since July 1, 2017. Before joining FICMAT in 2015 as the agency's chief administrative officer, Mike served a combined 13 years as interim superintendent and deputy superintendent of business services and governmental relations at the Riverside Unified School District. He has a long history in governmental relations, working closely with policymakers in Sacramento on behalf of California students. On December 13, 2023, I had the opportunity to sit down with Mike and take a deeper dive into the world of FICMAT. Our conversation was very interesting, and after speaking with Mike, I have a much better understanding of FICMAT's purpose and importance to the public education community in California. We think you will feel the same after listening to this episode of the CISC podcast. Mike, thank you for taking the time to be with us today. It's a pleasure to meet with you and have an opportunity to demystify FICMAT a little bit for our members. And I thought we'd just start out, Mike, with you telling us a little bit about your background and what led you to your role with FICMAT.
Sure, great, Bob. Thank you for having me. In my background includes about 10 years in the defense industry, and so I have I brought to school some perspective on private business and private industry. I spent all that time in on finance topics for large defense contractors. But for the past 30 plus years, it seems hard to believe it's been that long, but 30 plus years I've been with school districts. Started out in audit role and then in financial management, chief financial officer, assistant superintendent, deputy superintendent, and then I've spent time in the superintendent's chair on a couple of occasions. And for the past 8.5 years, I've been at FICMAT. What brought me to FICMAT, frankly, was an invitation from my predecessor, Joel Montero, and at the time, state leadership in the governor's office when Jerry Brown was in as governor, asking me to join the organization as Joel was thinking about transitioning to retirement or semi-retirement, and they were looking for somebody to step in behind him. And so it's been a great 8.5 plus years serving in this role at FICMAT.
Wonderful, Mike. I think before we go further, we should talk a little bit about what is FICMAT's purpose, and maybe we can include a little bit about the background, the development, how it originated. Just a brief history on that might be helpful.
Sure. So FICMAT's been around since 1992, but was established by the legislature in 1991 as a result of the Richmond Unified School District bankruptcy matter, or what I refer to as bankruptcy matter, but insolvency really is a more appropriate term. The Richmond issue started with the district running out of money and desire, and in response to that, wanting to close the school year 6 weeks early. And a parent in Richmond sued the district and ultimately the state to say, why should my child have 6 weeks fewer days of instruction versus yeah. somebody else. And in the court, in the California Supreme Court ruling in the case of Butt versus California, they laid out a process for the state to use around receivership. And as part of the legislature's response to codifying that process, they identified the need for an independent state agency that we now know of as the Fiscal Crisis and Management Assistance Team, or FCMAT, to provide assistance to school districts around this idea of prevention, so preventing the occurrences of fiscal crisis that lead to a receivership situation or insolvency, around training for local school business and school leaders, and then the administration, if you will, of the receivership process itself. And so the seminal bill of Assembly Bill 1200 in 1991 put all this in place, and 6 months or so later is when the state established, in response to that, established the organization. We are an independent state agency. A big piece of that independence is created in our structure, in that we, the state contracts with an administrative agent to host us. And that administrative agent, since the inception, has been the Kern County Superintendent of Schools. That's who raised their hand when the state asked who was interested in doing this. And they were awarded the contract to be the administrative agent of FCMAT. And so our independence comes in part by that separation. Instead of being housed at the Department of Ed or Department of Finance or the Comptroller's Office, a typical kind of control agency of the state, we have, we're housed outside of that structure. And that is to be able to say what we need to say, and both in our reports and verbally, and the advice that we give, both to the legislature and to local districts and community colleges and so on. Assembly Bill 1200 has probably been amended 50 some times since then, and some of those amendments have either added or clarified roles the FCMAT has. For example, adding charter schools to our list of clients, adding community colleges to our list of clients, expanding our role and county superintendent's role with regard to investigations of fraud and misappropriation of funds and those kinds of things. As an organization, we spend about 70% of our time on management assistance, which is when a district, a charter school, a county superintendent, or a community college pick up the phone and ask us for help in some area. We spend about 10% of our time on professional development. Those two things together, 80% of our time, we call that the prevention work. Another 10% of our time is spent on investigating fraud and other illegal fiscal practices in districts. And then another 10% of our time is spent on fiscal crisis. Those districts that are kind of way down the road, didn't heed the prevention assistance they were given, and have progressed closer and closer to some form of insolvency. There's a whole nother piece of our work on top of that 100% that people don't often associate to FCMAT, but that's data management work. So the California School Information Systems, or CSIS, is part of FCMAT. And they serve the California Department of Ed by operating and maintaining CalPATS, which every district and county office and charter school uses. And we're also the developer and the provide the maintenance for CDE's new SACS software system, which is how school districts and charter schools report their financial data to their counties and on to the state.
Well, I love the historical perspective you just gave us. I learned a lot just in this initial conversation, Mike. And then secondly, I would just comment, what a compliment to the Kern County Superintendent of Schools office to take on this role. It just seems like no one should be thinking KCSOS is in the background, being that we're located in the lower part of the Central Valley. We we take the lead on a lot of things, and this just seems like
you do. You have a long history that goes back that 30 years to some visionary leaders here in Kern. We see that, frankly, Bob, in your piece of the organization at CISC, right? A little different, not created by the legislature, a joint powers authority, and so on, but that statewide role, and certainly that's something that a former county superintendent here had that vision for in providing needed services across the state, and FICMAT and CISC are both great examples of that.
Well, great, Mike. I wanted to ask you, you gave a good overview of the types of studies. Can you zero in on maybe one or two examples so we even have a better understanding?
Yeah, I'll zero in on the bulk of our work, which is that management assistance. It's when a district, a charter school, community college, county superintendent reach out to us and ask us for assistance in an area. While it's commonly recognized that we do a lot of work in the areas of budget, financial projections, those kinds of things, we will actually assemble a team of experts to assist a district in any topic that they may be experiencing difficulty with, except direct instruction in general education. And I'm specific there on that exception because we do deal with special education. It's actually a decent size component of our work. And the tie to us in special ed is that special ed is a very high cost program and is often pointed to by many local educational agencies as a source of budget problems for them. And so that's what brought us into the special ed world some time ago, and we continue to have a robust practice in the area of special ed. But we'll assemble a team around transportation issues, including right down to looking at routes and the efficiencies, contracting out versus doing it in-house, food service, facilities, bond programs, governance issues, more typical business operational issues such as accounting and purchasing and so on. We don't do a whole lot in the area of risk management, mainly because there's robust partners out there for districts through their risk pools, frankly, to help them on risk management topics. And we have expertise on staff. We lead every job we do, we lead with a FICMAT staff person. Some jobs are all FICMAT people, but other jobs, for example, we will augment our staff on a short-term basis with expertise. So I'll give you an example. We currently do not have a staff member that's ever been responsible for the day-to-day operations in food service in a district. So when we get a food service request to assist with a food service problem, we lead that job with a staff member. We may even have a second staff member involved in it, but we will bring on board expertise in food service. That may be a retired food service director, maybe a current food service director who takes a leave for a week or 2 weeks from their job, takes vacation, comes to work for us during that period, so that we have not only the right number of people on each job, but also have the expertise on each job. So we staff up, if you will, through a variety of means to do that. We do the same thing in CSIS when we have a specifically area of need, a specific technology area, maybe a mathematician or a graphic artist for a piece of software for a 6-week period, something like that. We will go out and acquire that talent and bring them onto our team for that duration. So management assistance, that gives you some examples. We will tackle almost any topic there is out there that the district has a need for that kind of third-party set of eyes and ears and perspective.
Now, I think FICMAT has, tell me if I'm wrong, Mike, but I think they have some standard trainings opportunities for districts that you'll go out and perform. Could you give a couple examples of those?
Absolutely. So one of the statutory responsibilities FICMAT has is to train chief business officials and also to train other school district and charter school leaders, board superintendents, cabinet members, principals, others in the area of school finance. So most notably are our programs for aspiring chief business officials. We know that as the CBO, Chief Business Official Mentor Program. We are celebrating just even right now here in December the graduation of the 19th cohort of that group. So we've been doing it now for 19 years. Cohort 20 will start up in January. These are individuals from all kinds of backgrounds who aspire to be a chief business official. So it's a preparation program. And we're fortunate enough, there are three preparation programs in the state. We operate one, but we're heavily involved in the other two, in that we provide resources and we provide trainers and staff to do that training in the other two programs, namely CASBO has one and the University of Southern California has the other. Follow on to that program for new chief business officials is our coaching and induction program, which are for first, second, and third year CBOs. So we've gotten them, we prepared them for the job. Now they're in the job doing it, and so that they don't at the end of one day say, oh my goodness, this is what I thought I was gonna be, and run out the door. We provide them a professional coach, and we provide them a year-long opportunity to come together one weekend a month for instruction, a deeper dive in some of the topics. For example, January's deeper dive for the coaching induction program will be on the state budget. And the architects of the state budget from our state leadership, the Department of Finance, the Legislative Analyst Office, the State Board of Education, the Senate budget staff, Assembly budget staff, will actually be there with them that weekend, taking them on a deep dive and why they, what perspectives they have and why they propose certain things and so on. So those are two examples. We are also the primary trainer for the biggest area of fraud in the state, which is associated student bodies and booster groups. We provide extensive on-site training for districts and community colleges that have interest in those topics. And then there are a variety of other training programs we do. We do some programs, Bob, on our own, and we do some programs then in concert with other organizations, whether that be CASBO or AXA. We do aspiring principals session for AXA on school site budgets and school finance to give them some introduction and background to that. Charter organizations, authorizers, and other organizations we do a lot of training for. And then we have a whole set of products on our webpage that are all free to districts that are part of our professional development program. Those may be manuals, they may be software applications such as Projection Pro, which is a multi-year financial projection and cash management tool. But those are all developed and are free to our to districts and charter schools just by visiting our webpage.
Mike, tell me if this next question is too focused or too broad even to go into, but I know that FICMAT performs fiscal health risk analyses for districts. What might be some of the key points that our general listeners might want to understand about what that means?
So the fiscal health risk analysis, and we of course in this business have to have an acronym for everything, so we call it the FHRA. The FHRA is a deeper dive on FICMAT's longstanding indicators of risk and potential insolvency. And the indicators are 20 indicators. So they cover 20 areas of school operations, school district and charter school and community college operations that typically lend themselves when they're not operating, when they're not operating at full efficiency and effectiveness, to some type of distress or crisis leading to potential insolvency. They expose the district to financial risks and other types of risks. So an example of that would be budget development, budget monitoring, cash management, management of your employee agreements, your collectively bargained agreements, employee benefits, special education, your annual audit process and the results of that. The condition of your facilities, charter school, if you've authorized a charter school oversight. All of those lead to, when not done right or correct or not done at all, lead to elements of risk. The fiscal health risk analysis takes a deep dive on those topics. We have three tools that fall under this umbrella, one for TK through 12, one for charter schools, and one for community colleges. So let me focus on the traditional TK through 12 tool. It covers 20 areas, as I just gave you some examples. There are 130 yes or no questions. Yes or good answer. No is a bad answer, if you will. No tells us there's a problem, there's something missing. They focus on policy and they focus on practice more than they focus on numbers. And so they really get to a district's policy and procedures and practice about how they address these topics. And with the no answers comes a score. And that score, when you add it all up, gives you a sense of your level of risk. And it matches the Ed Code provisions that get into the areas of moderate and high risk. Which are triggers for county superintendents to invoke some type of intervention. And so it's a tool that, number one, the tool's on our webpage. District can access it, download it, or community college or charter school. So they could do a self-assessment with the tool or get the questions and the documents you would normally look at to answer the questions. Or you can work with us, enter into an agreement with us for us to come in and do the assessment for you. The assessment for districts that show signs of risk, as determined by their county superintendent, we will do the assessment and the state pays for it. So there's no charge to the district. The state covers that cost. Those are what we call triggered FHRAs, in that they're triggered by some event that leads the county superintendent to be concerned. And the state supports that work. So that the district has the information, has their deficiencies or gaps, and that they can then take action to close those gaps and deficiencies and correct things. It's back in the nature of the prevention of work, so the district doesn't get all the way down the road and start down the path of fiscal crisis.
So let me ask you on that, Mike, is that a process, the FHRA, is that a process that takes weeks, months? How would you describe that?
Triggered FHRAs generally are at least 2 months, maybe 3 months from start to finish. So contract or agreement through the scheduling process and then a report. We give those high priority because they've been triggered by an event, right? And so they are our highest priority. A request to do an FHRA that's not triggered, you'd probably add a couple weeks to that. It really depends on the nature of the request. Is it a new superintendent coming into a district and they kind of want some baseline information about their district, right? That's a little less priority than even a superintendent that calls and says, we're struggling with X, Y, and Z. We haven't quite hit that trigger yet. We'd like to avoid the trigger. Can you come in? That would be a higher priority than the example I just gave, but not as high as priority as the trigger environment. So as part of our intake process, we kind of talk to you and do an assessment with you so that we can gauge the importance and the urgency, and from there can schedule accordingly.
Mike, I know that a very important part of your work, but again, tell me if I'm wrong, but I don't think is quite as frequent, is what is known as an AB 139 extraordinary audit. That's a term that we hear, and I was hoping you could explain to us a little bit about what that entails.
Absolutely. And the reference to AB 139 is Assembly Bill 139 that put this provision in place. It's really a responsibility and authority of the county superintendents, the 58 county superintendents, where it gives them the authority to do a review of a school district or charter schools. Financial data and financial transactions when there's an allegation or suspicion of fraud, misappropriation of funds, or other illegal fiscal practices. And I'm quoting right out of statute. And it gives the county superintendent the authority to do that review. 99% of the time, the county superintendent turns to FICMAT to do those reviews. By the way, this is all Ed Code 1241.5. Subdivision B and C, as opposed to just looking at the entire AB 139, which includes a lot of things, but specifically Ed Code 1241.5. We have staff that are experts at fraud, and we have staff that are also experts in school business. So the value of FICMAT doing that review is you get somebody that for, 20 to 40 years of experience in doing fraud reviews and forensic auditing. You also, though, get school business expertise. So certainly a county superintendent could turn to a CPA firm to do the same kind of review that has forensic accounting experience, but they don't have the subject matter expertise. The value of us doing the work is that we bring to it also a thorough knowledge of what a charter school is supposed to look like and operate, how they're supposed to operate, same with a school district. The report then is issued and it has one conclusion, that there is evidence, sufficient evidence or not sufficient evidence to indicate that the allegation has some truth to it. Then it is left at that point for the state or local law enforcement to follow up. FICMAT doesn't go beyond that point. It's a fairly low bar that we have to reach. In the conclusion that we reach, but then there's potential follow-up to that by the local district attorney or the state controller or the Department of Education to go the next step in that process.
And does FICMAT have any responsibility for forwarding that report to local authorities, or is that left to the county superintendent?
Yeah, it's left under statute to the county superintendent. So the county superintendent becomes FICMAT's client, if you will. We deliver the report to the county superintendent. Statute gives them 45 days for them then to deliver the report to the what we call the subject entity, the school district or the charter school that was the subject of the allegation, to their board in a public session. So it's very public. And they are tasked with notifying, if there's evidence, they are tasked with notifying the state superintendent, the state controller, and the local district attorney. And what they do is they simply transmit our report to those entities. They don't have to do anything further than that. If there is no evidence, they don't have a reporting requirement, other than back to the district or charter school to just close the matter out, if you will.
Right. Mike, one of the reasons I'm glad I get a chance to talk to you today is risk pools like CISC throughout the state are beginning to feel the impact of Assembly Bill 218, which extended the statute of limitations with respect to childhood sexual assault incidents, which is a very heavy topic. And the purpose of this conversation is not to discuss any details of any particular case, but with this financial impact being felt now, where claims that were essentially non-funded from years ago, but a financial responsibility is being placed on risk pools, and sometimes when coverage that was purchased back in the day is not commensurate with the risk, yet it's unfunded, school districts may be faced with out-of-pocket monies that have to be funded. And I'm wondering if you see FICMAT having any sort of a role in helping risk pools, districts, and quite frankly, the state of California figure out either a new approach or an alternative approach. So that's a long-winded question, but you and I have had some conversations, and we're all trying to get to a better answer on this. I was wondering what you think.
Yeah, great question. So let me take it kind of in reverse order a little bit, Bob, in responding to it. So we have included this topic in our regular testimony to both the Senate and the Assembly for the last number of years. As was the case when 218 was passed, there was a identification of the potential for significant financial risk to school districts, all public agencies for that matter, as a result of it. But it is difficult to quantify because we didn't have this massive list of pending claims, right? Because of the statute of limitation, those claims were not before us. So we were always talking about this topic, about the potential, but difficult to quantify. More recently, as we've had several years of history now on these claims, we're starting to be able to quantify this a little bit better. And I think it's important that when the legislature acted on 218 and when it's considered subsequent bills on this topic, staff reports have been very clear about the potential for significant impacts, financial impacts. But despite that, the legislature did what they've done. Today, we're starting to see some of the results of that, and we are engaged with some districts over underinsured and uninsured claims, for example, that you've just described. And I'll go into that kind of process here in just a second. I guess the third category where you started, and that was assistance for risk pools. Unfortunately, risk pools aren't part of our client base directly, but they are indirectly in that districts are members of risk pools. And risk pools' financial solvency and health plays an important role in the district's financial solvency and health. The inability to obtain proper coverage, coverage at all, in some cases for some perils and risks, or too little of coverage in other cases, has a direct impact, as you've just alluded to, on the district's own financial solvency. So we have a strong interest in the health of our risk pools. And I have personal experience having been the president of a large JPA risk pool back in my district days, certainly my association through KCSOS with CISC, with SELF, and with some of our other risk partners. And so we've had the opportunity to have a regular conversation. But where I want to bring this back to is the assistance for districts and charter schools, even, who may find themselves in this situation. Charter schools are a little bit different in that there's not constitutional protection for charter schools. How they will deal with an underinsured or uninsured claim may very well put them out of business, and they will go through the federal bankruptcy process. The state isn't going to step in like they would for a community college district or a K-12 district who have constitutional protections. They are obligated to serve their community, the kids and the students in their community. Charter school doesn't share that same obligation. So for districts, our engagement has been, in many cases, with defense counsel, who wants to go into court and argue about the adverse impact that a judgment may have on the district. And so it's assisting defense counsel in describing that appropriately for the court and in clarifying the receivership process, the bankruptcy process. So first, all school districts, all public agencies in California have access to federal bankruptcy protection. To access federal, and we've seen that with cities, City of San Bernardino, City of Stockton, as example, have both filed for Chapter 9 for bankruptcy protection in the past. For school to file for protection under Chapter 9 of the bankruptcy law, you must do that in good faith, meaning you have no other alternative. For school districts and community colleges, they do have another alternative. And so that's why we don't see them filing for bankruptcy protection when they have financial problems. That alternative is to go through the state receivership process. And for K-12, that's well laid out in statute. I mentioned it earlier in the Richmond case, the Butt versus California, court decisions and the subsequent action of the legislature in AB 1200 and so on. For community colleges, it's less clear in that the statute's not doesn't lay out all the details. We've had one community college in 30 years require the state's intervention and receivership. So we have that model to follow, but that was crafted as we went, as opposed to it being in statute. So first off, federal bankruptcy protection isn't probably a player here on these claims. What is a player for a district most likely is to amortize the uninsured claim over time to minimize the annual impact to their budget. And they can do that through existing statute that allows them to amortize it over 10 years, no matter what. Or they could consider financing the claim, the judgment, or the settlement. And they would do that through judgment obligation bonds, just a regular public offering of debt, if you will, to Wall Street. An investor buys the bonds, and the district pays them on an annual basis. The key here in our way of thinking is twofold. One is we want to protect their ability to continue to serve their current kids. Anything a district pays is coming out of their current resources, their local control funding, or if they're a community funded district, out of their local current property taxes. And those are the same funds that are paying our teachers and are buying textbooks and are paying the custodian and the bus driver and turning the lights on in the classroom every day and buying technology and so on. So we want to first minimize that impact on an annual basis. And amortizing a judgment or a settlement over time helps do that, makes it more manageable for them. The second element that we want to focus on is it's our job to keep them from going into receivership, right? It's back to our focus on prevention. And yes, we would all love to have prevented the claim to start with, right? Prevented the action that occurred that resulted in the claim, right? And so we don't see receivership as a viable option when they could issue a judgment obligation bond. Receivership is just going to result in a loan, just like a judgment obligation bond is, but the lender will be the state, and they're going to have to pay it back to the state over, say, 20 years. In addition, the receivership process brings a change in governance. The local governing board likely will lose their ability, their authority to govern. The superintendent will lose their job. And we're talking about school board members, and we're talking about superintendents that probably weren't even present when the event happened so long ago, right? And so why are we going to paint that district with the current district and its current governance and leadership with this dark cloud when they weren't even around, most likely, when the event happened? And so it's been really to work with defense counsel and some districts to understand. We have some fairly large recent judgments that are either underinsured or uninsured. Those districts, you know, are in, the good news is the districts that I can think of right now that are in that case are in good financial condition to start with. They're not entering the judgment from a distressed situation. They've got some ways to manage this. But I think what's super important here is the legislature continues to contemplate this type of legislation. First is there's a reason for the statute of limitations to start with, and we kind of just blew that out of the water, right, with this legislation. But second is there is an impact on current kids. And I don't in any way want to minimize the victims in these cases, but there's an impact on current program and current kids. And we've got to find a better way to deal with that. I think, Bob, as you are far more the expert than I on this topic, we're going to see more and more of these uninsured and underinsured claims coming to light, because in many cases, the claims that were fully insured may have been adjudicated already in the time we've had, either through settlements or through other decisions. We don't hear a lot about them because the risk pools stepped up and took care of their various tranches of responsibility. The ones we're going to read about are where they have a direct impact. In all this, I also think it's important, and we have alluded to this in our testimony in the legislature, that there's another impact, current impact on school districts and charter schools and community colleges from all this, and that's the increased cost of premium, increased cost of coverage. Whether those are premium increases or deductible or self-insured retention increases, however you want to refer to those have immediate local impacts, especially when there's pressure for every dollar. And certainly as I begin to think about next year and very minimal cost of living adjustment, the state's own struggle right now with revenues, the impacts those will have on Prop 98 and school district and charter school and community college funding and so on. There are pressure points all over the place. Insurance premiums are probably the least of those, but we have to keep our eye on that. People have to understand when insurance premiums go up, when a district's faced with those uninsured or underinsured claims, that comes out of their current dollars in their current program.
Well, Mike, I thank you for that. I really think you and I could go on for about three more hours discussing these issues. Your knowledge base is just tremendous. And I just want to tell you how much I learned today, and I think our listeners are going to have the same experience
when they
listen to the podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you for all you do at FICMAT. Thank you for your years of service in the industry. And I look forward to maybe another session when we get a little bit further down the road with AB 218 and other matters. But I wanted to wish you the best of the holidays and just really enjoyed today. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob, very much. Great to partner with you.
We hope you've enjoyed this edition of the CISC podcast and greatly appreciate you listening to our show. Please check the CISC property and liability website at cisc.kern.org for a complete listing of podcast topics under the property and liability tab. Until next time, stay safe as we continue with the CISC mission of schools helping schools.
Production facilities for the CISC podcast are provided by KETN, a service of the Kern County Superintendent of Schools.